Coming up today, controversy reigns as Russia is caught editing the Wikipedia entry concerning the ill-fated Malaysian Airlines flight MH17. Plus, the British police force hoping to catch suspects with facial recognition technology. And in other face news, we learn that babies think dogs are cuter than humans, and we have science to thank for that knowledge. Also in today's show, a fantastic collection of your emails about some of last week's stories, and we debate whether the mission to infiltrate North Korea with pro-democracy information is a good move or a bad idea founded upon the best of intentions. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting from science.
Liv. My show. Hello. What are you doing?
Nate, welcome back.
Where have I been? Nowhere. Busy. Doing stuff. Doing things. But I'm less busy now, so I'm back. I miss saying that sentence. It's such a powerful sentence. Like, you really feel like you're in command of some sort of ship or vessel.
Yeah.
It's a podcast in real life.
I've been temporarily looking after it for you, but I'm very, very pleased that you're back, Nate.
Where are you going to steer it?
I'm going to steer it into the iceberg of news. maybe not. No, this is the Wired UK podcast, though, your weekly guide to the important and interesting, from science and tech to North Korea and faces. I'm your host, again, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
And I'm Olivia Interrupted Solon.
And I'm Liat Clark. Just Liat Clark.
Oh, it's good to be back. We've had some very nice emails about people commenting on our all-woman show recently, because there are no other all-woman tech and science shows out there that we know of.
Well, we've also had some, you know, lots of emails saying they wanted you back, so
yes.
It's a mixed bag.
They warmed the ventricles on my aortic pump. They really did. Now, it's been lovely to have had these emails, but yeah, I've been busy. But I'm back now. This is good. This
Yay!
Is good.
Yeah.
Well, it is for someone, except the person who emailed in said, maybe Nate should stay off. You should just have a podcast with all women on it. But we'll come to that later, because for now, it's time to lace up your information winkle pickers as we take a stroll through this week's news. Liv, Russia has been caught editing the Wikipedia entry about MH17, the Malaysian Airlines flight that unfortunately was, well, it seems it was shot down.
Yes, it was. And I think pretty much everyone would have heard about this already. It's been kind of wall-to-wall news about it. But very sadly, this flight was shot down and it killed all 298 people on board. At the moment, we're pretty sure it was done by pro-Russian rebels. But the day after it happened, there was a lot of uncertainty and there was a battle to rewrite history that started online. And the battleground for said battle was Wikipedia.
Yeah, now this isn't the first time this stuff has happened. We've seen these sorts of back and forth edits from supporting and unsupporting groups before. But
yeah, and sometimes they're done as a joke. Was it? Who was it in our...
Someone's done it recently who did it with something like a watering can, who said that it was invented by somebody or something like that.
Something obscure and pointless.
And yes. I was speaking to someone the other day who was trying to edit the legal height of a midget so that they could complain that their friend was a midget. Was it someone at Wired Money?
That's an incredibly awful way to win an argument. That person
nice.
Should go to bed ashamed. So, without digressing too far,
yes,
Twitter has been helping out.
Yes, so there are some very helpful Twitter bots that people have set up that monitor edits made from government IP addresses. And there's one that's been set up for the Russian government. Now, a bot found that someone from the Russian state broadcaster was editing a reference to what happened to MH17 in an article about aviation disasters. Now, the article originally said that the plane was shot down by pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine, which we now believe to be true. And a counter edit changed that the day after to say the plane was shot down by Ukrainian soldiers. And at the time, Russia was officially denying that it had any involvement in the disaster. But as we now know, it seems kind of pretty tricky for them to do that anymore.
Did they really think we would not notice?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps they didn't know about the this bot existing, and you know, they obviously didn't hide their IP address using any kind of VPN or something. But there are quite a few of these Twitter bots, actually. There was one set up quite recently by Tom Scott, who's a developer who makes lots of cool tools, and he set it up the UK Parliament Edit. At Parliament Edits is the Twitter account, and that obviously will show you whenever someone with a British government IP address starts making changes. And there's another one for US focused edits, which is called At Congress Edits. So if you want to know when people who don't know about masking their IP address make changes, you can.
I think this is much more useful for the proliferation of good, useful information than that plant that tweets every time it gets sub-moist and needs watering.
Well, it depends if you're the plant or if you are a citizen in favour of transparency.
What is a plant if not a denizen of the soil, Liv? I'm actually personally quite fascinated about historical revisionism and rewriting history in general. Mm. And this seems to be a case of that just happening in real time, in a sense, because a lot of people do rely on Wikipedia as a source for information. And at certain points, there are a lot of lies on there. Whether or not this is a lie still has to be proven. But that... Do you think?
I think it will. Well, it sounds like there will be no such thing as historical revisionism because we will all know exactly what's happening when.
Okay.
Who's changing it when? Immediately they are guilty because they've changed it.
Have you edited a Wikipedia entry to win an argument? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. Now, it's common knowledge that many beasts, dogs in particular, are more attractive than their owners. That is science, people, fact proven. But now we have science to thank for babies thinking dogs are cuter than humans. Liat,
yes. This
has you written all over it.
I know.
Specifically at the top where I put Liat next to this headline.
You put Liat Wang, actually.
I did, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so this is actually a study that relates to all things cute. Cute, when you think of cute, I don't know, I think we'd all agree, well, maybe not all of us. Babies, kittens, puppies.
I don't think babies are cute.
I knew you were going to say that.
They all look like frogs.
A lot of people like them. A lot of people appear to be genetically drawn to their giant,
and related
creepy
to
eyes.
Them.
Anime babies are quite cute. Because anime characters generally tend to be cute. Because
so
they have big eyes.
Anime babies, but not human babies.
It depends on the context. Yeah. If I was giving birth to one, I'd prefer it to be a real one.
thank goodness.
Another digression.
Anyway, so actually an ethologist, Conrad Lorenz, mulled over this same question, not the anime part.
So hang on, what's an ethologist?
Well, Olivia, it is in fact the scientific study of animal behaviour. This guy has all kinds of specialities, but this came in handy when finding out, you know, what we think is cute in animals, baby animals. It's also known as baby schema, and it's basically high forehead, round face, you know, the chubby cheeks.
Big eyes.
Big eyes, yeah, exactly. Liv is circling her face right now. She is super cute. She's got a beautiful face.
Chubby.
And button nose. She's got that too. So these are the things that apparently why we're drawn to them. And, you know, this does extend to our love of animals somewhat. But we're, you know, that side of things has not been investigated much. And also, at what age do we start to have these weird feelings toward baby faces? Because according to Conrad Lorenz, this kind of was related to an instinctual reaction in adults who want to protect this round face that looks really vulnerable. I don't know why round faces look vulnerable, but that's what he said. Chubby. So a team from the University of Lincoln has decided to look into just this, they've decided to look into kind of the human-animal relationship when it comes to this, and also how old we are when we start having these bizarre impulses to stroke animals walking past us. So they got a bunch of kids, obviously, some aged 3, some aged 5, some aged 6, and sat these guys down and showed them different pictures of animals, babies and adults at different ages. They actually morphed them to have super childlike features or adult features. So they have, you know, especially round eyes, but it's the same animal in all the pictures.
But this is cats versus kittens, dogs versus puppies, adults versus babies, which are cuter?
Exactly. Okay. Well, surprise, surprise, the kittens, puppies and babies were cuter. They did this in one side of the study by tracking, using eye tracking software to follow where these 3, 5 and 6 year olds were watching, and also actually asked them to rate on a scale of 1 to cute how cute each one was. You'd probably not be that surprised to find out that they all liked the baby pictures. That's the point of this story. However, dogs trumped everything. Didn't matter what age they were, dogs were the favoured faces. Adult dogs, baby dogs. Humans came last.
Wow.
Way last, after cats. But there's a lot of kind of interesting studies that can come off the back of this. Why does a three-year-old need to feel protective to a baby? They're not going to do anything about it.
Interesting. My first thought when I read this story, though, was we're more used to seeing human faces than animal faces.
So it's
It's novelty. Yeah. So it has some sort of inherent feeling of this is a bit different. This is a bit unusual.
I was thinking that even at the age of 3, I think, which is how old the kids were, you already have loads of like fuzzy, fluffy cartoon characters around of animals rather than people. And so that might be why you're more drawn to fluffy puppies.
We do in our culture, but do we know anything about whether these people were from the same ethnic background? Or because if these are all, you know, 3, 4, 5 and 6 year olds who grew up in Lincoln, it's highly likely that they're watching the same English and American TV that has the same sort of imagery. Whereas we've seen studies in the past relating to how people think about, I think, childbirth, life and death and things like that from radically different social and ethnic backgrounds. They had a very different view of, you know, whether death was depressing or good or what have you.
Under threes don't all necessarily watch a lot of TV. I mean, some do.
But they've done studies where under threes recognise brands, you know, brand logos and stuff like that.
So
I think it gets absorbed.
And also they're going to be given cuddly toys and things like that. One of the things that the authors did flag up was if they had, they counted whether they had pets at home, but they didn't investigate the relationship between the child and the pet. So if the child had a particular special bond with the pet, or if they were involved in caring for it and looking after it, and therefore obviously the feelings of wanting to nurture the animal would emphasize this. But they did focus on the features very specifically. They went to the eyes and the nose and the mouth, which again you probably do that when you're talking to someone anyway.
That's great, and I've got good knowledge that if I need to, you know, I want to win a cuteness competition, I should enter a dog, so to speak, not a human or a cat. What does this actually mean? Can we do anything useful with this information?
Yeah, something quite cool, actually.
Go on.
A study was done a couple of years back whereby they showed adults pictures of adult animals or puppies and kittens and then got them to do a task afterwards. And in every case, they found that the adults, if they'd been looking at pictures of super cute, like really cute kittens, puppies, they couldn't just be like the medium-aged ones, the teenagers, had to be puppies. They were really good at playing Operation afterwards.
Wow. So they focused better, didn't they?
Yeah. It's basically quite a few studies on attentiveness, but also fine motor skills. So they've suggested that perhaps in the future, this has taken them straight to robot dogs. We can use robot dogs in the classroom to fine tune. And anyone with behavioural issues, kind of taking them through kind of cognitive development skills as well as motor skills and just life skills, guys. So the robot dogs in the classroom is basically what these researchers want us to start planning.
That's really interesting. Plus, actually, there was a study, wasn't there, where looking at pictures of cute animals for a certain amount of time per day measurably lowered blood pressure. And so can be used as a treatment for stress.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, we covered it. We wrote about it. It was a couple of years ago, I think. Now, but
I thought that was
the
one you were talking about. It was about improving concentration.
Yeah.
No, but this is attentiveness, like for basically doing tasks as well, and the fine motor skills that one needs when playing Operation.
Well, you can read more about this. If you search for babies dogs on wired.co.uk, you will find the article Babies Think Dogs Are Cuter Than Humans, and you can read more there. Good news, Time fans. The release of an Apple smartwatch just took another step closer to being a thing, as Apple's patent on a product called iTime was made public today by the US Patent Office. We have thought for a while there's going to be a device called the iWatch, Apple's entry into the smartwatch market, which is doing, well, not well, but it's certainly growing. And this touchscreen device that has been published today is detailed to be able to show notifications from apps or incoming calls or messages from paired phones and Macs or presumably iPads as well. Plus, there are mentions of GPS accelerometers for determining arm and wrist gestures. Keep your sniggers to yourself. Media storage and playback. And one of them has a detachable screen. There's another design that's a bit slimmer and it does not have a detachable screen. And I think one of these designs looks exactly like one of those old iPad Nano watches, where when Apple was doing the square touchscreen iPod Nanos, people started buying these sort of rubber wristbands that you could slide the Nano into. And it was basically an Apple Watch. And they changed it. And some people speculated at the time, like, oh, they've seen that people want to wear these things on their wrists. Maybe we should develop one. And this patent application looks exactly like one. It's really bizarre.
But then that doesn't sound super exciting.
No.
As in, where's the innovation?
It has sensors in the strap. Fact one.
Okay.
We also know that Apple is investing quite a lot of time and effort into health monitoring applications in iOS 8, which is due to come out in probably September, along with the new iPhone 6, which we also reported about today, if you want to go and have a read about that. It's going to be bigger, 4.7 inches, by the way, and a 5.5 inch model. Just going to slip that in there while you're paying attention to Apple News. And it could well be that there are monitoring sensors in that for monitoring things like heart rate.
Perfect place for it.
Exactly. The Galaxy Gear has, the Samsung Gear or the Gear Fit, they have those sorts of sensors and connect to Samsung's health apps.
But is there anything in it that you think trumps the Gear and the functionality?
Well, 3 years ago this was filed. I mean, it could have anything since.
But this is 3 years,
but that's pretty standard. And
But, I mean, the technology that you file about 3 years ago will have massively evolved, so it's hard to say whether or not it's.
But bear in mind that patents are all about describing what something does sort of functionally, in a sense, and it, you know, the screen technology might be higher resolution, but they don't have to say it's got a high res screen. They just say it's usually something like device for the electronic presentation of computerized information. It's all very if you read this patent filing, as I read through, you do find your eyes drifting a bit and you find every sentence feels like deja vu because there's so much repetition.
They make it so vague that it could incorporate anything.
That's the problem with patents, particularly software patents, but we won't get into that now. So it's quite exciting. September seems like a likely time for this to be revealed alongside iOS 8 and the iPhone 6, as mentioned, as well as a new set of iPads. There's a rumour again of a massive iPad Pro, although the leaks from that have been practically non-existent, so I don't know why anyone believes that's still a thing, but there we go. I'm quite excited about it. I mean, I find actually that I used the Samsung Galaxy S5 for a few months because I just realised I hadn't really used Android for a while, and I liked it. I found it was a bit too big, and I went back to the iPhone 5S. But when I was using the Gear Fit for the notifications, as much as I liked it, I kind of started to resent it, thinking, well, I know I've got loads of email. I know that. Being buzzed about it every 30 seconds does not give me any more useful information other than it's mounting up, it's making me stressed. Get rid of it. So
I definitely don't want it in work email.
Turned it off. I turned email off my phone as well, just for those periods where I don't want to be bugged. And so it needs to have something more useful than just notifications
and
for me
to care.
And
you need to be able to select easily what notifications you want. That's the thing. You don't want...
I'm not excited about any of these paired devices. Until it's a complete replacement for my phone and it has a battery life, you know, that's similar to, well, not as long as an actual watch, but it's really, really long. I just don't see the point of having two devices.
Well, unless it's
unless
doing
it does something
novel,
completely different.
Like we're talking,
but it's not. It's the notifications isn't interesting. No. I'd just rather have a health monitor that's paired with a phone.
Yeah. I can see some uses. I mean, bearing in mind, if you have your iPhone or your iPad or your computer docked, you could theoretically walk around your office without having to carry your phone around. It's not a very heavy device to have anyway.
But the battery life's rubbish.
The battery life's getting better. So the Gear Fit, for me, when I was using it, would last for about 4 days between charges.
But yeah, but I guess I'm comparing it to a watch, which, you know, your expectation of battery life for something around your wrist
is just another thing to charge as well. Yeah, if it's going to be useful.
That's true.
Every
and you know what?
Day.
I was talking to a woman, I think she's called a digital anthropologist. She works at IBM. No, she works at Intel. And she made a really good point about one of the problems that we have with devices not having very long battery life isn't that they last only a day. It's that we're not in the mental cycle to remember to charge things every 3 days. Everyone is fine now with charging a phone every day. You put it on charge when you go to bed, you use it for the day and you repeat. Some things last about a week, some things last like a month, like a Kindle or something. But, you know, 3.5 days is a really rubbish period of time. And it is, as you say, definitely going to be a key factor.
Well, no, you can adapt to anything like that, but it's just a pain. It's an inconvenience. They should all charge on pillows.
Yes. Well, I agree. Well, we have the images from the patent filing and some details and a bit of my speculation on the website. If you go to wired.co.uk and search iTime in the usual Apple format, you will find my piece. Liv, the UK police, it has hopes. And those hopes revolve around catching suspects with facial recognition tech. Regardless, Liat, of how cute they are, they'll arrest kittens, the British police force, if they're committing crimes. That's how thorough our forces are. Is
true
that not true?
True dat. Yeah. Yeah. So we've heard quite a bit about facial recognition technology being used by various police forces. I think in Boston, they tried to use it to catch the Boston bombers, and with pretty much no success.
Our police force put a whole bunch of suspects' photos on Flickr for people to identify during the London riots.
Yeah, and I think also in Brazil during the World Cup, supposedly some police were going to be using smart glasses with facial recognition software. I'm not sure how successful that was. But this is the first time a UK police force, it's the Leicestershire Police Force, is going to trial facial recognition technology to actually help solve crimes.
And it has the best name of any police technology I have ever heard.
It does.
What's it called?
Neo Face. Badass, right?
Fantastic.
Yeah. So it's actually quite clever. So it's not just kind of pixel matching types of facial recognition that we may have seen in the past. Neo Face is a computer program that automatically searches, processes, and matches facial images held in large digital mugshot databases. And the aim is to speed up criminal investigations. So a police officer can take any new digital image. So that might be from CCTV or from their body cameras that they have to wear. And they just enter it into the system. And what Neo Face does is enhances that image and then kind of compares it to this database, delivering a list of likely matches based on how likely it thinks they are. And so it takes dozens of biometric measurements on the face, and then it increases the accuracy by converting the 2D images into 3D ones using an interesting process called morphing. And it then tries to generate a good frontal face image from a series of different images at different angles. So this makes it easier to match any new image to another image in the database that might be taken at an odd angle, because obviously we very rarely get shots of suspects unless they are the official mugshots taken full, you know, frontal, so to speak.
What if you've got a twin?
Well, if you've got a twin, it will probably pick up on you being a likely suspect, because actually they've done some trials with the software and found that it can even identify family members related to the person they're trying to identify.
Isn't that how they ID'd a shoplifter? There was a story that there was a specific case where they ID'd a shoplifter off his family members. And then you get the weird example, which is like, has anyone in your family done anything in the last few weeks?
But that's the thing. They can't use this as evidence in court. What they're using it is to narrow down the list of suspects to then bring in for questioning. So at the moment, this technology has not been approved for use as saying this is proof that it's the same person. It's more about kind of very quickly determining which people on the police database they need to call in for questioning.
I like this. I do like this. I think I'm a big fan of using tech.
Yeah.
For things.
And what I like about this, I think if it had gone the step further where, you know, you've got police wearing smart glasses with this sort of technology, it starts getting onto privacy invading territory. But this is more, you know, just speeding up processes that police already carry out.
I guess there can be a lot of accidental lines of questioning opened if it's going for family members. Anyone with similar features is going to crop up.
But it's doing a process that is already is currently done manually. Currently, yeah. They will go on a computer and look picture by picture to see if anyone looks similar. So that would be happening anyway.
Right. So it's not.
This
so
is just
much.
Automating
it's just
that process.
Up.
I'm with you. It's just automation of something that already exists.
Yeah.
Well, I imagine there are people listening who think this is a bad idea because we have a lot of people who care very strongly about privacy and the control of their information and things like that. So if you have an opinion for or against this, I'm particularly interested if you think this is a bad idea because we. I've spoken quite positively about it. Do get in touch, podcast@wired.co.uk, and we will read out your opinions and discuss them next week. One last quick news story to get to before we move into our discussion and our feedback loop sections. Liat, relatives of the deceased could get legal access to all of the data from that deceased person. This seems like a good move.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting one. There are kind of two sides to this. Obviously, like most things in life, many sides to it. But there's been quite a few legal battles over the past few years, and that's what's instigating this. It's probably not something you or I have thought about much. You know, what happens to my Facebook messages? It's not your priority generally day to day in life. But quite a few families have taken the likes of Apple and Google to court to compel them to unlock devices in some cases that have been left to people in their wills or open accounts of these deceased relatives. Now, all these companies, their terms and conditions would state, you know, this is personal information, it cannot be accessed without the individual's consent. And of course, kind of wider privacy laws, which would back that up. But a group in the US called the Uniform Law Commission, which is a non-profit that helps kind of standardise laws across the country, is proposing a new law that would totally get around this and actually make it the default that families can access accounts. It would make it so that it trumps your right to privacy and the company's terms and conditions. And if you didn't want this to happen, you would have to specify in your will that you do not want your relatives to have access to it. So for that reason, I'm not sure if I'm 100% on board with this, because this is, you know, obviously there are a lot of cases where, well, I don't know. There are very specific circumstances where you might want to access a loved one's email. You might want to know what was going on in their life at the time if something terrible happened. But just because, you know, you're not there, should your right to privacy die with you? Discuss.
Well, I guess you don't really care about it anymore because you're dead.
You don't care about it because you're dead, but there might be many reasons why you've got personal information there that you have passwords locking it. Like, you don't want your parents to see your sex, for instance.
No, that is absolutely true. But then that's in the same way that if you think in the real world, if you die and you leave behind photographs or, you know, everything, you know, I always feel like you should kind of keep whatever the case is in the offline world, take it online. But this is different because online you have much more data and you can segment things with passwords. I think it shouldn't really be something you have to specify in your will. It should be something you would be able to specify within the service that you're using.
That's what I mean. That's how I feel about it, because obviously not the majority of people are not going to know about this law if it did come into effect. Which makes it completely unfair. Mm. Whereas quite a few companies, or you know, some of the bigger companies are starting services to help you get around that. You've got memorial pages on Facebook, and you've got something called the Inactive Account Manager, very sexy name from Google, which lets you select whether everything's deleted after you haven't accessed it for a certain amount of time, or it automatically gives another person access. And then you're taking control of it, because like you say, you know, you're not I think quite a few kind of privacy advocates have come out to say that there isn't a comparison in the real world, because you don't keep millions and millions of letters of correspondence, or you might if you're a hoarder, but you know, maybe you filter it out and just have the nice ones there.
If you have a view on this and whether you would like your digital life to be passed on to loved ones, let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. That's all the news for this week, but still to come after a short break, we're going to talk about the conference aimed at promoting quote-unquote hacking of North Korea to get more information into the country, but specifically how that information should be taken in. Plus, we've got a great selection of your feedback and emails to get through. Do not miss that. We'll be back in a moment.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000. including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. Our discussion segment for this week is under our category, Oh No, They Didn't, and we're going to talk about North Korea. In this segment, we are going to be talking about how Hacking North Korea is set to become a two-day event in San Francisco in September. The event is called Hack North Korea, with a goal of brainstorming innovative ways to push information into the secretive nation. Now, we reported about this after a story appeared on the website North Korea Tech, which was syndicated onto The Guardian, and it was promoted by the organizer. And the event is being run by the Human Rights Foundation. These guys are a non-profit team. They're based in New York, and they say they are, quote, dedicated to promoting freedom where it's most at risk, end quote. Certainly, that matches the description of North Korea, which is famously locked under a political regime that does not allow freedom, or in fact, it's basically 1984. So the agenda for this two-day event, which is going to begin on the 2nd of August, actually, sorry, I think I said September earlier, is to educate Western delegates on the methods currently used to smuggle information into North Korea. Now, these usually take the form of little USB sticks, CDs, and radio and television is broadcast over the border, so people who can access that at quite a significant risk to themselves can get information from South Korea. And the rest of the time, they're going to come up with new ways to do so. And they've got a bunch of North Korean defectors there, as well as people pulled from Silicon Valley, to try and think, how can we hack more information into North Korea? Now, we reported on this group, I think, last year, around the same sort of time, might have been June or July. And they were doing a part of, well, this is part of the Disrupt North Korea project, but last year they did one where they were loading Wikipedia onto USB sticks, loading them onto balloons and flying them over the border. And it got them some pretty harsh threats from the state propaganda service. They were threatened with death and all sorts of horrible ways to die.
Well, I guess in that context, it's so easy for North Korea to say that is the West sending their propaganda over. Like, who's to say it's real? Who's to say any of it is real?
Well, there is a risk, a growing risk to the regime over there of more and more information slipping into the country because of things like the fact they have mobile phone service over there. They do have computers. They have an internet, but it's more like a government intranet rather than an actual internet. Only very, very senior top people are allowed access to Western internet. And usually that's to gather things like news that's happening around the world, so it can be rewritten for their state-controlled media, which is the only, they're the only people allowed to write news, and it is quite literally just rewritten and made up.
And presumably they have to get kind of emails from Dennis Rodman, get his Facebook likes.
Yeah, exactly. So that all happens. But it raises a bunch of interesting questions, because on the one hand, there are some horrific human rights abuses taking place in many parts of North Korea. It really is an area stuck in the 1960s in so many ways. And a lot of people quite rightly think, well, this needs to change. It's going to collapse eventually, and we have to facilitate that for the benefit of the 25 million people that live in the country. The problem is, what would happen if 25 million people suddenly did learn that they've been lied to and cheated and suddenly did want to defect or leave? How would a neighboring country like Russia or China or South Korea deal with the influx? They already have a lot of defectors, and it costs South Korea a lot of money to re-educate them because they've spent their entire lives not knowing what's actually outside the barriers of North Korea, and a lot of them commit suicide way higher suicide rates for North Korean defectors because they can't adjust to life outside of what they're used to.
Presumably everything you've been living for your whole life has been a lie, and you have to come to terms with the fact that all your family believe and all your friends believe that lie. I think that must be incredibly destabilizing.
Well, I would have thought what the tricky thing here is also, how on earth do you deliver that message to someone without them coming and living somewhere else? Because you send a USB stick with Wikipedia or whatever on, you know, you have no idea what the source is of this information, where it's come from, who's written it. You don't know what Wikipedia is, perhaps. Mm. So this just could be the encyclopedia of our enemy, that this is how it uses propaganda against our country. How on earth do you even begin, not just to get the information in, but to get the right information to kind of open people's eyes without, like you say, causing mass...
But it exists,
and there are
people in the country, a lot of people in the country, who do know that they're being lied to, and they do get this information, and they do have computers, and they have PCs, and they have universities that have computers, and they can load this stuff. They run Windows, like they can do it. And the problem is that if enough of that information gets in and can then start to be distributed, do you sit with a revolution on your hands? Do you have a social uprising? Like, what would happen?
Yes.
And I'm not saying that shouldn't happen, but the fact is that this sort of stuff probably needs to happen quite slowly, because if it happens too quickly, the sheer social mess that would happen of, you know, a crumbling regime and 25 million people who can barely keep themselves alive at the best of times anyway, suddenly need to flood somewhere else. How do you do that? How do you manage that?
Well, on top of that, a lot of people, even it would surely be people in urban environments that would get this information anyway. A huge portion of the country live in rural areas and would not have any access to this information. So if there was some kind of social uprising in urban...
They'd never know, you're saying.
Well, yeah, maybe they'll just section off the country there.
It's a really good point. I mean, the thing is, I know it sounds a bit grand to think that, you know, coming up with, you know, an audacious idea to leak information into the whole of the country. But I mean, if there was a way to fly, you know, planes over the whole country and just a mass airdrop of information and media across the entire country, which obviously would be unfeasible, but when we're talking about a conference set up to come up with innovative ideas of ways to spread huge amounts of information to an entire population, like, that's not completely out the realms of possibility. And I think that the ramifications of that on a social and political level are really interesting to consider, because I think it's kind of like the whole smoking debate. If you just ban cigarettes right now, the tax implication alone would be devastating, and the health knock-on to that, people with suffering from addiction, like, that's a major problem. So it has to be done in steps. They make them really expensive. They stop putting adverts out. They stop doing this. And it's a case of phasing it out over the course of some generations.
But then who's to say that 25 million people would just defect and leave the country, as opposed to having some kind of revolution and then rebuilding the country?
Absolutely.
But it's about breaking the control the government there has on its people, because they can only control the people while they're afraid of what's outside and while they're largely believing what they're told. If everyone knows there's some doubt there, it's going to be very easy for that, over a short period of time maybe, to bubble.
But I would have thought, actually, there's no way, even if you could drop mass information over the entire country and every individual picked it up, that wouldn't be the way to disseminate information. It has to come from people, your own countrymen, people and women, people that you trust, people that can, you know, from an outsider dropping something in whatever shape or form. It's not going to have the impact of having the country's own citizens make a marked effort to spread this information and do something about it.
But that is what the Human Rights Foundation, when they did the drop, they used weather balloons to send them over the border. They have leaflets, like just paper leaflets that are made from a paper that doesn't dissolve in the wet. And they did have pictures of defectors, people who said, "I am a North Korean. Yeah. I have left North Korea and I'm now living in China or South Korea or wherever they're living." And very, you know, picture explanations of what they've been up to.
See, that's interesting. When I heard this, I thought, I hope that, you know, people at the conference, it's being headed up in collaboration with people like that, because those are the people whose voice you should be listening to, not just someone who has an incredibly complicated but exciting way of getting the information in.
It is interesting that it's being held in America, which North Korea despises.
Yeah.
They have school textbooks. You know, when we're in school, you're taught numbers by things like oh, if you have two oranges and then you get three oranges, how many oranges do you have?
Yeah.
In some North Korean textbooks, instead of that, they use dead Americans.
Oh, wow.
And they say,
oh,
if you have two dead Americans and three dead Americans, wow, how many? And they do the same with tenses. So, you know, I killed Americans, I am killing Americans, yeah, oh, I will kill Americans. Oh, like, it's that level of xenophobia and fear,
yeah,
that's at play here. So I find it interesting that this is being held, obviously, by a US nonprofit, being held in America with North Koreans. It sort of heightens the, yeah, potential threat there.
And that's the number one thing there is, yeah, you'd never listen to your enemy if you knew it was coming from them. And also, if you're an American growing up with your views on democracy and equality and the way the world should work, and a country, well, a lot of countries say America's exporting of ideals is not what they want, then is it necessarily the right group to, I mean, no,
but
they,
this human
they
rights group is great. They're really close, got close affiliations with the region. It's not like, yeah, they're kind of complete rookies on this.
Oh, well, then great. I was just thinking, like, in terms of how someone portrays it, because you have to really, you have to think in a completely different way. You can't just, yeah, transport your ideals and put them down on paper and assume someone's going to pick it up and agree.
I think the key thing here is to get Dennis Rodman, reprogram him as a sleeper agent and send him back over to see King.
How do we
Daniel?
Know, not know that he is not?
Let us know what you think. We've tried to present a few options here, for and against. But podcast@wired.co.uk is where you can send your views on whether this is a good idea, a bad idea, or any views you have on getting information in and out of North Korea. And now it is time to jump in to the feedback loop. So we've got four brilliant emails today, or possibly five, actually. I'm not sure, but we picked out some fantastic ones this week. The first comes from Ken Fallon, who said, "You asked in episode 183 how people can listen to so many podcasts or shows. Sorry. Well, now that your feed has been added, my own podcast list has expanded to 163 podcasts. The only way I can listen to all of them is to speed them up, that and have a long commute. I currently listen at 2x speed." That's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah.
I do that with my audiobooks. I do 1.5 times so I can get through them faster.
2x is chipmunk speed, isn't it?
It's close to that. But some podcasts, some of the software actually levels out the pitch.
Okay.
So it just plays them faster rather than increasing the pitch. Anyway, but his main point was on the right to be forgotten issue, particularly in terms of search results and removing articles from Google, etc. He says, Ken continues, "While this is a foreign concept in the US and UK, it is a well-entrenched law on the continent. The law is based on the belief that people can rehabilitate, and is why here in the Netherlands no criminal is named even after conviction. The important point is that this is not a right to be completely forgotten, just enough to allow you to make a fresh start once you're out of prison and have successfully completed or are continuing whatever restrictions have been given to you. As an example, childcare workers will need to provide a cert from the police stating that they are suitable for a care position. The police maintain records of the crimes and will only issue the report if the person is suitable. As the applicant needs to request this, if it is refused, they can withdraw from the job application process without alerting the prospective employer to the fact that the police refused to issue the cert, the certificate." Now, I find that really, really interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of our credit rating system in the UK, which checking your credit rating can affect your credit rating because it might be seen that you have something to worry about, which I find to be weird. But he said he also mentioned that he learned about our show on Dave Morris's podcast, which I haven't heard of that, but thank you, Dave Morris's podcast.
Amy has written in to say, "I've just listened to the most recent podcast and thought I'd comment on the issues of Parliament closing down for the summer. Now, this was when we were kind of ranting about the surveillance law drip last week, and it came up, what are they doing over the summer for 3 months?" She says, "From what I remember from secondary school citizenship lessons, this is to allow MPs time for constituency matters. This is obviously a key part of their job, but one they don't get much time for when Parliament is sitting, especially MPs in cabinet or on special committees. Like you, I'm against the idea of MPs having a whole summer off. So long as they really do use it to help their constituents, then I don't mind. On another note, while I miss Nate and wish him all the best, it has been so refreshing to have a trio of wonderful tech ladies looking after the podcast. Most of the podcasts I listen to are fronted by men, especially the technology ones, and it's great to see that Wired employs brilliant female staff. Thanks for the wonderful output every week, Amy." Thank you.
Well, sorry, but I wasn't gone. I just wasn't doing the podcast. I am here.
But we still have majority.
I was going to say, it's still majority ladies. And I decided to read this one because Stephen wrote in and said, I believe that Nate should step down from the podcast permanently because these past few podcasts have been the best ones. It would be a brave and courageous decision on his part to have an all-female podcast. Please consider this not because we dislike you, but for the better good of podcasting as a whole. Sorry to disappoint you, Stephen, but I just had to come back when I read that, so I'm here. It's a sadness in my heart, a sadness, but yeah,
well,
it's fine.
I'm glad Nate's back, that's for sure.
Well, I was very, very genuinely heartwarmed with a number of people who kept emailing in and asking about when I'm coming back. It was I had a few people message last week when you teased that I was coming back this week, asking, is it true you're coming back? It's quite nice. And I wanted to mention something because the nicest thing happened the other day on this topic. One of our commercial team had gone into the Apple store to get her iPad fixed or something, and she somehow mentioned that she was from Wired, and the guy that was helping her said, oh, when's Nate coming back on the podcast? And when she told me that, I was like, that guy is brilliant. You've made my day. That's fantastic. If you're still listening, email me, nate@wired.co.uk, and I'll buy you a beer. We'll go and talk Apple. Well, we've got one more email that we wanted to get to. And this is from Hiroshi, who writes in from Japan. He says, hello, ladies. I'm not expecting me to be here. I could put on a girly voice. I was listening to the last wired.co.uk podcast, and as I happen to understand Japanese, I needed to comment. And he was commenting, actually, on the story that was covered about the woman arrested for the vaginal art
3D printed
vagina that she got done for being indecent, I think. Hiroshi continues, the police say they arrested her because she distributed sexual materials in public. And he points out that online is public in Japan, and not because she was making vagina-related art. The same logic that having 3D data for making guns is legal, but making it downloadable is illegal. Here are two discussions. One, she calls herself a manga artist, a comic artist, but the police wrote in the official statement that she's a, quote, self-claiming manga artist, end quote. And here, that's widely discussed in that the police undergrade her public status in the public statement, even though she's got history of doing art for some years. She even published a book about her artwork in 2012. The second point, Hiroshi continues, is that she claims the statue of David with his penis is art, and her body part is also part of art. She organized a workshop, probably for women only, Hiroshi comments, making the vagina art with her, and the blog says it was very popular. She knows what she's doing, and she'd say she's challenging the common sense that the female part is to be hidden while the male part can be placed out in public, depending on where and when. She's extreme, in my opinion, but she's got a good point as well. I hope the issues she has raised is fairly discussed. Looking forward to hearing the next episode, hopefully with Nate as well. I'm here for you, Hiroshi, largely because I love Japan.
So I wonder what the porn issues are in Japan, because...
Well, they're quite complicated in that they're not allowed to show genitals. So even in any legal porn that shows full frontal penetration has to be blurred and pixelated
out. What about online, though?
Same. Yeah, you can be arrested for distributing unpixelated pornography in
Wowza.
Japan.
So we've got it good, really, here.
We have it. We're more lenient.
As in, are porn laws impending?
Exactly.
But that kind of highlights the point, the Statue of David thing. You know, she did say, I mean, I think we discussed it, that in pop culture, penises are much more widely celebrated than vaginas are. And it's true, even in statues. I know lady bits are kind of more concealed, but you never see a fully...
No,
fledged.
You only see boobies.
Yeah, exactly.
There is actually...
Why are boobs less offensive?
Because they're more natural, unless you're Facebook, in which case beheading videos are more acceptable than a nipple. But we've gone over that before. There is actually a festival in Japan, I think it's a fertility festival, where people walk around with penises and big giant penis sculptures, and everyone worships penises. And they have penis paraphernalia for sale.
In Japan?
Yeah.
Why have they not
It's called
been
the
arrested?
Kanamari Matsuri.
Because penises are all right. Vaginas are not.
That's redunk.
Exactly. So there's a bit... of I don't know if that is that chauvinism, is
bits
that feminism?
Bias.
It's bits bias. But that's going to do our show for this week. It is very nice to be back on the show, and I'm glad that most people seem to like our female heavy formats.
We're not heavy guys.
And also wanted me to come back and do it. So I relented. I'm back again. We'll make the time. It's fine. But of course, you can get in touch, podcast@wired.co.uk, with any of your comments on any of today's stories or anything you want us to talk about possibly elsewhere in the news. You don't have to just tell us about stuff that we've talked about. Tell us what you think is going on that we should be discussing more of. podcast@wired.co.uk. And we will see you, I think, next week.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.